Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Since the Watergate era, American politics has worked under campaign finance controls, limits. 40 years on, the caps are being blown off. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional a decades-old limit on total contributions by an individual, on contributions in effect by the rich. This is protected speech under the First Amendment, wrote Chief Justice John Roberts. His court is changing American politics. This hour on Point, money, politics, and the Roberts Court. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see here? A ruling for freedom, freedom of speech, a ruling for wealth and its power in our democracy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. In a moment, we will speak with Sean McCutcheon, the plaintiff whose suit made it all the way to the Supreme Court. He's a businessman from Alabama and a Republican donor. But first, I'm joined by David Savage. He is Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. David, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What was the argument that the Chief Justice and the other four court members going with him made to overturn these limits?
Well, as you said, John Roberts and the four who join him see this as a matter of the First Amendment freedom of speech. And he said, before the government is going to suppress speech or limit speech in any way, it has to have a really strong, really powerful reason. And we're not convinced that these overall limits really did much. And so, therefore, it fails the First Amendment test.
What was the argument that was made to impose them? It was about corruption.
Yes, I think in the Watergate era, the first argument that was made in the 70s is that the individual limits won't work if there's not an overall limit, because I guess the scheme would be I give $1 million to some party committee because I really want to aid my local congressman. I can't do that, and so I'll give money to some group in Washington, and it'll get funneled back to the congressman. So that was the first argument, what they call circumvention. You go around the limits. But in the fall, when this case was heard, Don Verrilli, the Solicitor General, said, this is really about a type of undue influence in Washington. If you strike down these total limits, some person, a wealthy person, can go up to Capitol Hill, go to John Boehner, go to Harry Reid, and say, here's a check for $3.5 million because I'm maxing out on the contributions for every member of the Republican or Democrat in the House, everyone in the Senate, and that person, a person who walks up and says, I've got a $3 million check, is going to have a heck of a lot of undue influence in Congress.
Chief Justice Roberts said, that's not clear. What wasn't clear to him?
Well, none of it is clear to him. And I must say, I read his opinion. Unless you really are a great believer in that this is a matter of free speech, it doesn't come across as all that convincing, because I'm not sure, you know, if you were to poll your listeners or poll the American public, how many people would feel their right to free speech was crimped because prior to yesterday they could only give $123,000 in contributions to members of Congress? I don't think most people would immediately think, oh boy, I don't have a right to express myself, or I don't have a right to participate.
But maybe, David, that's just because they don't have the money. If you've got billions and you can give millions and it's no big deal, maybe your freedom would feel crimped. I mean, we know that people in that circumstance have complained.
No, you're absolutely right. There were 700 people who bumped up against this limit a couple years ago. There clearly are a group of wealthy donors who would say, I'd really like to give more than $123,000. I'd like to give $3 million because I want to, you know, have my voice heard. I'm just saying that if you talk about it in ordinary parlance as a matter of my right to freedom of speech or freedom of expression, I don't think that's the way most people think of free speech.
The argument made here for taking down this particular limit, where does it put the court on the arc of further dismantling campaign finance controls?
what sure looks like that's where they're going is because John Roberts has said in several opinions now that the only thing that the government can do is try to prevent what's sort of akin to bribery. The government can't do anything, state, federal, that sort of tries to level the playing field or, you know, make sure that there's some people don't have an undue influence. Well, all these laws sort of, the limits all sort of operate on the assumption is we don't want, you know, billionaires and millionaires to have undue sway on members of Congress. And John Roberts has said you can't do that. And so there are some remaining limits left. For example, there are limits on how much you can give to parties. And they look like that might be the next line of attack, that somebody's going to say, hey, I want to give more than $50,000 or whatever to the party. And it's going to be very hard to defend those limits in the Roberts Court.
The Chief Justice writing that the possibility that an individual who spends large sums may garner influence over or access to elected officials or political parties, not enough. He said the only acceptable justification for limits would be to root out quid pro quo corruption and or the appearance of it. And he said that just isn't going on.
That's right. I mean, he's basically, in a series of opinions, has rejected almost all the defenses for the 1970s era limits on spending and contributions, because he says, you know, the government can't do that. They can't say some people have too much influence, so we're going to limit their spending or limit their giving. And if the government can't do that in Washington and they can't do it in the states, there's not many limits that are going to survive.
Justice Clarence Thomas said, go further, take off all the limits.
Yes, that's typical of Justice Thomas. That he likes to stake out the positions and say, if you want to be pure about this, if we really want to say this is a free speech matter, we ought to strike down all the limits and do it now. And I think he's just a little ahead of his colleagues.
The dissent written here, 5-4 this, and the dissent written by Justice Stephen Breyer saying that taken together with Citizens United, today's decision eviscerates our nation's campaign finance laws, leaving a remnant incapable of dealing with the grave problems of democratic legitimacy that those laws were intended to resolve. He spoke up in the chamber, as I understand, David, not just in the text of the dissent.
Yes, every so often, once or twice a year, when there's a really big case, the dissenters feel very strongly. They read the dissent in the courtroom. Breyer read a long dissent yesterday, and I think he's trying to say to the public, look where we're going. We're heading down this road of knocking down every limit on how much people can spend, how much they can contribute, and we're going to fundamentally change how politics operates in this country if you give the very small group of wealthy people ever more power to influence how the laws are made.
Did Chief Justice Roberts, in his opinion, give any credibility to that concern, any weight to that concern?
No, very, very little. I mean, he understood, he said, you know, there is a legitimate concern about corruption. If people are sort of buying specific favors, I'll contribute to $10,000 to your campaign if you promise to vote for this bill. But other than that, he said it's all a matter of everybody gets to participate, and this is all about free speech, and that's the way he views it.
David Savage with the Los Angeles Times covers the Supreme Court. David, it's always good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I want to go to Sean McCutcheon. He joins us from Nashville today. He is an Alabama businessman who was the plaintiff here in this case, along with the Republican National Committee. We talked to him when this was coming before the court. His side has won. Sean McCutcheon, welcome. Thanks for joining us again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
How do you see the significance of this ruling in your favor, Mr. McCutcheon?
Well, I see it as very significant. Obviously, I'm very happy. I think change in politics is good, especially when it involves individual people who worked hard, made money, and helped contribute to the country. And I can't understand why anyone would want to limit the free speech of rich people or anyone else in a free country.
Do you have any concern that the interests of the rich, as you put it, might outweigh those of other citizens, that it somehow has a deleterious effect on democracy itself, sir?
No, I do not, because this is about free speech and communications and political campaigns. It's about transparent donations, and it's about running ads, TV, radio, mail, or every other way you can, any kind of media you can use. So it's all out there. It's about spreading good ideas and better ideas in the political marketplace. I think it's fundamental American free speech. This is supposed to be a free country, and why in the world would you want to limit Americans from engaging in campaigning? To me, it's just fundamentally very clear and very important, and I'm so glad. I mean, it's not like we're buying guns with the money or something like that.
Why do you think we had these laws in the first place, Mr. McCutcheon?
I think it was a result of the Nixon era, and it was just they were in the right place at the right time. But again, I believe the laws favored incumbency. They're basically designed by Congress to regulate how Congress gets reelected, which is, most Congress people are concerned about reelection. So to me, the laws have a slant towards incumbency, which is not necessary. I think we need to put it back in the hands of the people outside the government.
Are you going to open your pocketbook and get back in a big way with this new freedom to spend on politics?
Absolutely. I'm going to celebrate, and I'm going to try to support more than I ever have, and certainly look forward to doing it.
Sean McCutcheon, he is the plaintiff, along with the Republican National Committee, on the side that just won before the United States Supreme Court. The decision came down yesterday, 5-4. Mr. McCutcheon, I guess congratulations are in order. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Supreme Court's big move on big money politics and other cap-blown-off political contributions in yesterday's decision. Kind of predictable response in Washington yesterday from all sides, but let's hear it. This was John Boehner, Speaker of the House, sharing his reaction to the Supreme Court ruling, likening it to the rights that reporters enjoy.
What I think this means is that freedom of speech is being upheld. You all have the freedom to write what you want to write. Donors ought to have the freedom to give what they want to give.
At a press conference yesterday, Democratic Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse called the court decision, the court itself, totally out of touch with how elections work.
The discussion of corruption and how it works in elections is amateurish and naive to an extreme that boggles the mind. And it really makes me wonder whether they've thought this through.
But Republican National Committee Chair, Party Chair Reince Priebus said, hey, let's just give political parties First Amendment rights like everybody else.
It brings the political parties, I think the most accountable groups in America, a little bit closer to exercising our First Amendment rights just like everybody else.
Because the gates are most opened here for contributions to the parties. Well, let's hear the debate. Joining us now from Morgantown, West Virginia, Bradley Smith, chairman of the Center for Competitive Politics and visiting Copenhagen Chair of Law at West Virginia University. In 2000, he was nominated by President Clinton to fill a Republican-designated seat on the Federal Election Commission. Served for 5 years, including as chair of the commission in 2004. Bradley Smith, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
And with us from Washington, Fred Wertheimer. He is founder and president of Democracy 21, which advocates for transparency in government and campaign finance reform. Fred Wertheimer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here. Nice to be with Brad again.
Bradley Smith, what do you make of yesterday's ruling by the court and the way the Chief Justice articulated his view of the arguments?
Well, I think it's a good common sense ruling. I mean, here's basically what you had. A person such as Sean McCutcheon could contribute the legal maximum to 9 different candidates, but if he contributed to a 10th candidate the same amount, suddenly that was deemed corrupting and he couldn't do it. Why was the 10th candidate corrupted but not the first 9? There's really no logical argument for having that aggregate cap in that respect. Now, the response that Fred will make in a moment, I'm sure, and that Justice Breyer did, were these wildly bizarre hypotheticals. For example, contrary to what David said, I mean, he wasn't wrong, but he said, well, somebody just walk up to John Boehner with a $3 million check. No, that's not the way a joint fundraising committee works. You can't just walk up to John Boehner and hand him a check and say, I want to contribute to all the legal maximum to all of the Republican candidates. In fact, there was not a single joint fundraising committee that ever reached the aggregate limit before. What makes us suddenly think that now there will be joint fundraising committees that will raise far, far more than the aggregate limit? That's not how those systems work. And when those are done, the money is not just there for the party leaders to divide as they see fit. It is allocated in advance to specific candidates and parties. Similarly, in the states that don't have aggregate limits, and most of them do not, there has never been this problem. And Justice Breyer's only response was, well, there's probably a lot of lawbreaking going on in the states, and we just don't know about it. I think that's a pretty thin reed on which to give the government the power to regulate our political speech. So I think it was a good decision, common sense decision. It is one that will make a difference. It's not a dramatic game changer for the very reason that David and others have suggested, that there aren't a lot of people who are going to give that amount of money.
Fred Wertheimer, Bradley Smith says, look, don't get all upset. This is common sense. But we heard the Sheldon Whitehouse, Senator Whitehouse, saying that this is an amateurish and naive view to an extreme that boggles the mind of what goes on in American politics. Now, how do you see what's been ruled here, Fred?
Well, I don't think it's common sense. I think it's nonsense in terms of the view that the Chief Justice expressed. This court is clearly on a step-by-step process to destroy the country's campaign finance laws. They have a radically different view than decades of previous Congresses, decades of previous Supreme Courts. To deal with one of the comments Brad Smith just made, let's look at the 2012 presidential campaign. President Obama and Mitt Romney each created joint fundraising committees. They asked donors to write a check for $70,800. Why? Because that was the maximum the donor could give under the aggregate limits. If you take away these aggregate limits, the maximum a donor can now give is $1.2 million. Now, let's see who's naive here. Justice Roberts, or the views expressed by Senator Whitehouse? Here's a memo issued yesterday by Covington and Burling, a leading law firm in Washington, explaining the impact of this decision. And they write, they're talking about super PACs. These super PACs will be able to accept very large contributions in a single check. For high net worth individuals, this means they will be able to write fewer checks than before, but now with much greater impact. Going forward, we expect today's decision will increase the political powers of members of Congress with a strong relationship with high net worth donors. We also expect it to increase the influence of major donors. This case was not about what Mr. McCutcheon could do. It was much broader than that, and it has returned the claims to the contrary, $1 million and $2 million checks being written by individuals in the future. We'll see who winds up naive here when we see what happens. But I will tell you that the history of campaign finance and money in politics is that candidates and political operatives will do whatever they are allowed to do. And in this case, they are allowed now to solicit six- and seven-figure checks.
Bradley Smith, in this environment, how do we keep congressmen and women, congresspeople, from becoming pets of high net worth individuals? How do we do that, Mr. Smith?
Well, look, for most of our nation's history, an individual could give as much as he wanted to a candidate's campaign. He didn't even have a limit, let alone an aggregate limit, on what he gave to a particular candidate. That's how we elected Eisenhower and Truman and FDR and Kennedy. And, you know, life didn't come to an end. And so part of the argument here has to be to ultimately say, wait a minute. How's this working out for you, as Dr. Phil would say? It's only since 1974 that we've put any limits on individual giving to campaigns, right? It's a 40-year experiment. Now, since 1974, do people feel like our politics are better, that special interests have less influence, that the rich have less influence? The answer is no. And the reason for that, there are reasons for that, which I have detailed in a series of books and law review articles. I mean, it's kind of more than one can talk about in a couple minutes here on the air, but basically it goes to how money actually works in politics and how people actually act. What I say to listeners is, look, just look at the results. And look at the period, you know, a guy like Fred has been pushing this for years, and he said if we didn't act this stuff in 74, it'd be terrible. He has said that every Supreme Court decision since 76 is wrong. Now he says, well, they're changing, you know, but he hated the decisions in 76. If we look at how it's worked, incumbents have a greater spending advantage over challengers now than they did before we put these limits in place. Incumbents are harder to dislodge from office than they were before we put these limits in place. I don't think anybody thinks there's less corruption. The era of McCain-Feingold, those few years of maximum regulation, where the era of Jack Abramoff, the era of Bob Ney, the era of Duke Cunningham was the California congressman, had like a schedule of bribes you could pay him. So I go back and just say, ultimately, look, people, let's look at the results and see what's worked. And you know, we've tried it Fred's way for a long, long time, about 30 years plus, and then the court finally began cutting back on it. Has it really been so bad since the court has begun cutting back on this regulation?
Let me put that to Fred Wertheimer, if I may. How about that test, Fred? How's it working out for you? And practical impact of this, do the wealthy have more influence? Is there more corruption? Bradley Smith says not.
Well, let's look at what we did, why we did what we did in 1974. It was a response to the worst campaign finance scandals in at least a century, if not in the history of the country. And Congress recognized, and the president recognized, and the Supreme Court recognized that contribution limits were necessary to prevent what the Supreme Court said then was an inherently corrupt system. Now, I don't think the country is better off since the Citizens United decision, with Sheldon Adelson and his spouse putting $92 million into our elections. And I do not think the country is going to be better off by returning to the million-dollar huge contributions that were made to the political parties that led to the soft money scandals of the 1990s. The only people affected by this decision are the relatively minuscule number of the wealthiest people in America.
Who can afford to give at these levels?
It is millionaires and billionaires who are going to be able to write these big checks, and not the more than 300 million people in this country whose voices and interests are entitled to be heard.
But Fred, what about Bradley's argument that, well, okay, but we elected Eisenhower and JFK and a lot of other presidents who are admired under the old system, and furthermore, that these decades since we enacted these laws have not been exactly paradise?
Well, you're never going to have paradise, but these laws did curb corruption. They did curb problems. We then had to enact additional laws. This is always an ongoing basis. We also had President Nixon, who ended up with the worst scandals in modern history. If you want to judge where we have been since the Watergate scandals, we made progress. We didn't solve all the problems, but we did make progress, and we had to keep correcting to deal with new scandals. But what this court is telling us is they are taking away the ability to curb the corrupting influence of huge contributions and big money in our politics. That is not going to be good for anyone other than people who can afford to give $100,000 or $1 million or put $92 million into our elections. Now, if any of your listeners can afford to do that, I would ask them to raise their hands. This isn't about free speech. This is about using money to have distortive influence on elections and to have the ability to have undue influence on government decisions by a relatively handful of Americans.
Bradley Smith in West Virginia. We have all seen the charts that show the concentration of wealth that has unfolded in this country in recent decades. People now who can afford to spend tens of millions, $90 million, $100 million on campaigns. Doesn't that worry you as a citizen of this country? I mean, you know that money comes with influence, and there's so much concentrated money here. Isn't that a risk? Isn't that a present threat?
Again, we don't make constitutional law on a monsters under the bed theory. let's go back and look at
they're the not under the bed. They're out there.
Let's go back and look at the history of what's happened in this country, right? I basically heard Fred say a long, long answer that was to say basically, yeah, this hasn't really worked in the last 35 years, but we should keep trying to do more of it anyway. That's basically what I heard his answer. And he said clearly, this is ongoing. It's always ongoing. It never stops. There always must be more regulation. And this is precisely the problem. Let's think about this. I mean, Fred keeps making this argument now. Well, you know, there's only a few hundred people, right? Well, what if we said, well, let's do away with Miranda rights. There's only a few hundred people who make involuntary confessions. That's not very many, and most of them are criminals anyway. After all, they're confessing to crimes. So let's do away with Miranda rights because it won't really affect most of our listeners.
But what about the
Mr.
Smith, excuse me, what about the practical functioning of democracy? Let's say one person had all the money.
Well, okay, let's talk about the practical functioning of democracy. That's exactly my point. Nobody can really show any benefits from all of these laws. In fact, what we find, like Fred obviously doesn't like Sheldon Adelson, right? Sheldon Adelson spent a lot of money. That kept Newt Gingrich in the presidential race for a while. Was that a bad thing? For Newt Gingrich supporters, that was a great thing. For millions of Americans, their ideas, their voices were heard.
But they didn't elect Sheldon Adelson.
Sheldon Adelson made their voices heard. It's a mistake to think that somehow if you get the money out of politics, suddenly everybody's going to have equal political influence. Rather, what we want to do is not give the government the power to decide who's been heard, what voices should not be heard anymore, which is what Justice Breyer says in his dissent. He says, well, there's sort of a general Rousseauian will of the people that should determine what the people think. When Sheldon Adelson funded ad supporting Newt Gingrich, that gave voice to millions of Americans. And as you point out, in the end, even more millions of Americans rejected those ideas. It was not bad to have that debate. It was good to have that debate. It was better than if we didn't have that debate.
Fred, it's good to give Sheldon Adelson or some other wealthy person the microphone to speak for those who might not be spoken for otherwise. What do you say, Fred?
Well, I don't like or dislike Sheldon Adelson, and I object to Brad Smith's comments. I dislike the idea that one individual or two individuals can put up $92 million to influence our political system. I just think that's wrong. Now, Brad Smith is talking as if the decisions made by this court since Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito joined the court reflect the ultimate wisdom of Supreme Court jurisprudence. But since 1974 up until the change in this court, the Supreme Court has pretty consistently upheld campaign finance laws. His claim that I objected to the Buckley decision is wrong. I did not. So we have had Supreme Courts who have basically recognized for decades that huge contributions are dangerous to our political process because they have the capacity, they create opportunities for corruption. We have decision after decision made on that basis.
The Chief Justice says there's not even an appearance of corruption.
All of a sudden, the new court comes along and they go up into an ivory tower and come down with a new ultimate truth. This isn't an ultimate truth. This is a radical change from where the court has been for decades, and it does not hold up. It's not going to hold up in terms of reality.
But it's held up in the Supreme Court. I mean, there's no higher court of appeal. It's been held up right there.
Well, sure. I mean, they're the ultimate deciders here, and we're going to have to live with it. But the country is going to be subject to great damage as a result.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Supreme Court's big move on big money politics, another cap blown off political contributions. Fred Wertheimer is with us, founder and president of Democracy 21. They advocate for transparency in government and campaign finance reform. Bradley Smith is with us from Morgantown, West Virginia, chairman of the Center for Competitive Politics, was on the Federal Election Committee, appointed to a Republican seat there by President Clinton, was chair in 2004. By the way, you can read the Supreme Court decision in full at our website, onpointradio.org, and it makes Pretty interesting reading. We heard a couple of Republicans earlier. One Democrat, here's another Democrat, Chuck Schumer, New York senator, telling reporters that campaign funding already is heavily influenced by big money.
The very wealthy should be allowed to participate in the system. But most people would agree if you did a balancing test, already their wealth, their weight is disproportionate, and this makes it more so.
This makes it more so, says Senator Schumer. I want to get our listeners in here. Lots been waiting. Mona in Boston. Thank you for calling, Mona. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question and a comment. My question is, how could they say this is freedom of speech? This is freedom of money. How could they equate money to speech? And by doing that, aren't they saying if you're poor, you have less freedom of speech, and if you're rich, you have more? And my comment is that I think it's ironic that all the Supreme Court judges who were elected, appointed by the Republicans, which I consider the party of rich for the rich, have been on that side. But again, my question is, how could they equate money to freedom of speech?
We've got it. Bradley Smith, if money is speech, is that in effect a disenfranchisement of the poor, those without money?
No, I mean, here's the basic equation. Right now, there are 9 justices on the Supreme Court. All 9 of them agree that this is a First Amendment issue. And that was also the case. There's all of the judges that have sat on the court since Buckley v. Valeo, with one exception, have agreed that this is a First Amendment issue. And the reason is simple. It costs money to speak. If we limited how much money NPR could spend, we might not have this show on the air. If we limited how much money the New York Times could spend, it might not be able to publish. People need to spend money to get their message out. So it's clearly a speech issue, and that is not in dispute. The only real question that's in dispute is whether there are countervailing interests that are sufficient to allow the government to limit the speech of some. Now, it's true that if you have money, you can speak more than if you don't have money, right? But that's how a lot of things work. If you have money, you can hire a better attorney than somebody who doesn't have money when you go to court. If you have money, you can buy more guns than somebody who doesn't have money. If you have money, you can buy a newspaper station or a radio and speak station to your heart's content. So that's just part of the consequence of the system. But everybody agrees that this is about free speech. The question is simply whether or not the government has a compelling interest to override those free speech interests.
Fred, how's the court looked at this over the years? I mean, you hear Mona's concern there. If money is speech, then the poor are disenfranchised. Variations on that, I'm sure the court has turned over time. How's this thinking evolved?
Well, actually, the court has not said that money is direct speech when it comes in the form of contributions. The court has said it's indirect speech. It's removed speech because you're giving money to others to speak. And as indirect speech, it is subject to being limited if there are compelling reasons for it. And the compelling reasons for it up until yesterday were the ability to use money and contribution form to buy influence with government officials and to, in effect, small c, corrupt government decisions. Contribution limits were not based on the fact that they could only be there to prevent quid pro quo corruption or bribery, which the court made clear in 1976. The court said, look, if this is only about preventing bribery, we already have bribery laws. Now, the current court is changing that view, and they're changing that view in a way that they're so narrowing the corruption issue that, as Senator Whitehouse pointed out, they're dealing in an unreal world in the way in which American politics function. But I would point out that there is a difference between all the examples that Brad Smith used about money influencing or money, the role money plays in other areas.
Buy a newspaper, buy a radio station.
In this particular case, the money is being given to people who make decisions about how our taxes are raised, how our tax money is spent, who gets financial benefits, who gets regulations or gets free from regulation. So the money is being spent, given, in our view, to influence elected leaders who are making decisions that affect all of us.
Fred, that goes back to Bradley Smith's earlier question about how all this is working out for you, for the country. Are you saying that we're seeing legislative policy tilted toward the interests of the wealthy because of this court?
Well, I mean, this court just made this particular decision yesterday, but this decision certainly will tilt the system towards the wealthy, as did the Citizens United decision. But look, I'm willing to discuss this in terms that the court has discussed it in for the last 30 years until the Roberts Court came along. I'm willing to discuss this in terms of having limits in order to prevent the ability, the opportunities to corrupt government decisions. In 1976, the Supreme Court said if you have huge contributions or unlimited contributions, that creates an inherently corrupt system. This court clearly rejects that idea and is taking us in a completely different path, and a path that I and I think many, many people think is a very dangerous road to go for our democracy.
Bradley Smith, there's just to a kind of native intelligence, the potential for corruption here, which is behind the accusation, the allegation of naivete. Doesn't there feel like some naive? I mean, how can one say that you can put in millions and millions and you don't end up tilting the policy toward your interests, that you don't end up, in effect, corrupting?
Again, I think that's the wrong question, right? Obviously,
why?
Some people have more influence in politics than others, and people get influence in a lot of different ways, right? And the best way to assure
that suggests not one man, one vote, but $1, one vote, or $1 million. You know what I mean?
Well, all these dollars can do is try to convince people to vote for certain politicians. That's what they do. If you want to bribe a politician, you just bribe them, right? You don't need to give them campaign
contributions. Oh, but that's not how it works. I mean, isn't big campaign contributions... Surely. I mean, we've seen Alan Simpson and others over the years. You don't think that influences how a politician votes?
Many, many things influence how a politician votes. Studies over the years, and I mean, this is literally dozens of studies, have consistently found that there's not the strong connection, that people essentially are like Sean McCutcheon. They give money to candidates who already agree with them to promote the ideals that they agree with. And those candidates go out and use that money to campaign, and people vote for them. Now, the alternative is to give the power to the federal government to decide who's spoken enough, who's spoken too much, who has too much influence. Maybe we'll decide that Fred Wertheimer has too much.
Well, what do you mean the federal government? We're talking here about our elected representatives.
Right, that's the federal government.
Well, that...
Right? Well, but look, the federal government...
It's not some disembodied volume of clerks.
Well,
But
the majority cannot just go out and say, well, we're going to silence those views we don't like. We're going to silence some people. And that's the danger you give. The government is no less dangerous because it's elected. It still has power. That's why we have a First Amendment. So why not say that Fred Wertheimer has too much influence? He spends a couple million bucks a year. It comes to him almost entirely in foundation money. It's not accountable to the citizens. He has no accountability. He doesn't have to disclose his donors. You know, now, I don't mean this as a personal attack, Fred. We could use any of these groups. Why are they allowed to spend money, right? And they spend money to try to influence public policy. And that's what the political system is about. And the best way to assure that nobody gains control of it, one reason we have the First Amendment, is to prevent the government from picking favorites, from choosing who they want, to allow people to challenge the government and speak to their heart's content. And that's been very effective. And I keep going back to saying, since we changed course in 1974, we've got nothing to show for it. And Fred says, well, he supported Buckley, by the way. Fred filed a brief against the plaintiffs in Buckley on the side of the government calling for all this regulation. So it's rather disingenuous. This is the point they have taken, the reformed lobby has taken for 40 years, and it hasn't worked. And now, you know, all these claims about how awful Citizens United was going to be, show me where it has actually made the government worse in terms of achievement and what we're able to accomplish in America.
Yeah, Fred Wertheimer, I'll bring that to you. Let me get David in Hartford, Connecticut first. David, you're on.
Hi, one thing I don't think that has been brought up in this discussion is that, you know, the founders, when they wrote that all men are created equal, they didn't mean they were all 6 feet tall or all had the same IQ. Politically, the ability to have influence over the direction of their lives within society was what they wanted all people to have. And, you know, when you give power to somebody, say in Alabama, who wants to give millions of dollars, that will, some way or another, find its way to influencing an election in North Carolina, say.
Mm-hmm.
That is a jurisdictional issue, which is very problematic because all of a sudden, a single person's voice, a single person's First Amendment right, so-called right,
mm-hmm.
has more influence than the citizens within that jurisdiction of North Carolina, in my example.
Yeah.
And the representatives in North Carolina should be working for their citizens and not for the interests of First Amendment people who want to have influence beyond their own jurisdiction.
David, we take your point. Let me hold that one right there and get one more quickly. Charles in Broadway, Virginia. Charles, you're on.
Hi. Who gets their speech heard in members in the halls of Congress? It's clear, demonstrable, and uncontestable evidence that the contributors to political campaigns who gain face-to-face meetings with members of Congress, this is speech, isn't it? And it's the communication of ideas by wealthy directly to members of Congress. Few others obtain the frequency or length of time, an hour or more, to actually speak with members of Congress. The rest of us, the other 3 million, therefore have little or no voice.
Or 300 million, buying sway, you say there, Charles, and we've got it. I appreciate your call. Fred Wertheimer, you hear the arguments being made by our callers there about basically, you know, don't let my vote be stepped on by somebody who's got a billion or millions behind his vote. What do you say?
Well, first of all, I would like to say that I don't think we have to worry about me having too much influence. And I don't think that Brad Smith is really worried about me having too much influence.
But Sheldon Adelson would say the same thing. Don't worry about me having too much.
Well, I don't have it. And Sheldon Adelson does. I think everyone, or most people, realize that if you're providing a lot of money to an office holder, you are creating opportunities to influence that office holder. And when you're dealing with million-dollar checks, as we will be after this decision, you have the opportunity to buy results. Now, the idea that anyone engages or has to engage in bribery today is ridiculous. Duke Cunningham is the rare example of someone in Congress who walked around with a list charging people amounts of money to do things for them. But when you have a system that allows me, the donor, to give you $1 million and you, the recipient, to take a position that I want, we don't have to articulate that an exchange of the money for the government decision result. No one does that. But everyone, certainly the Supreme Court until very recently, has recognized that huge contributions can buy government results. And when wealthy people have the great advantage of giving huge contributions to control government decisions, that comes at the expense of everyone else, and it comes at the expense of our democracy. And it is going to be a huge problem going forward.
Fred, let me get one more call here, if I may, for you maybe. Matt in Cleveland, Ohio. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Matt in Cleveland, feeling a bit helpless in Cleveland today. I'm kind of wondering, what do we do? The majority of people listening to this show today are probably upset, if not outraged, by this decision. What can we do? Because it seems to me, maybe I'm too cynical here, but if I write in the same whole routine, send an email to my representative or senator, it seems to me that they're going to listen to Matt in Cleveland, who wants to take away essentially a windfall of money that they've suddenly received now.
Yeah.
How are we going to dial this back if we're upset about it? What do we do?
Matt, thank you for your call. Fred, I mean, a Gallup poll, this was last year, but found 8 in 10 Americans, given the opportunity, would vote to limit the amount of money that candidates for the Senate and House can raise and spend. Today, it's those who want to be able to spend who are celebrating. Our caller from Cleveland wants to push the tide the other way. What can he do?
Well, these kind of battles take time. They take long periods of time. So you have to engage in the battles and be in for the long haul. There are laws that can be passed, even under these decisions, that will ameliorate their impact, laws that empower citizens by making their small contributions more important, more effective disclosure laws, laws that can curb some of these super PACs that are really arms of candidates. But in the end, and I'm sure Brad Smith and I will disagree about this, I do not believe these decisions will hold up over time. Now, that's not going to satisfy the caller, and it's not going to satisfy me, and I don't know when it will happen. But I feel quite confident that these decisions will not stand the test of history.
Boy, history is long. Bradley Smith, you know, we've been, U.S. has been very critical lately of Russia and oligarchs and all that. That gets thrown back in our face when people say, well, look, in your country, people have a whole lot of influence. You don't, where's your one-man, one-vote system, America? Risk there, Bradley?
Tom, it gets thrown back in our face, too, when you have a First Amendment that says you can't limit speech except when the government thinks it's really, really important to limit speech. That's one of the great things about our First Amendment is it applies even when people don't like some of the speech they're getting. And I think our democracy's success stands on its own merits. And I think the failure of campaign finance regulation since 1974 is a self-indictment of the idea that we need more regulation.
Bradley Smith in Morgantown, West Virginia. Fred Wertheimer in Washington. Thank you both for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.